This podcast is Challenging Opinions and is presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading the Challenging Opinions podcast for February 26th, 2018. The Heartland Institute is the industry-funded lobby group campaigning against action on climate change, although sometimes it's unclear whether they say human-caused climate change doesn't exist, or exists but is harmless, or is dangerous but pointless to mitigate. Let's ask their senior fellow in energy and the environment.
Opinions is the podcast where ideas are tested. Whether you are left or right, conservative or progressive, devout or skeptic, what matters is the strength of your argument, not the strength of your voice.
On the phone now, I have Sterling Burnett. He's a senior fellow in energy and the environment at the Heartland Institute. He's also managing editor of Environment and Climate News there. Sterling, Heartland Institute is really known as an organization that does not accept the standard scientific view of climate change, particularly that comes from the United Nations. I'm wondering, are you now accepting the science and rejecting perhaps the idea of what should be done about it? Or does the Heartland Institute still not believe that climate change exists?
The Heartland Institute has never denied climate change exists. You'd have to deny the entirety of geological and human history to deny that.
Sure. To get our vocabulary correct, we mean climate change. By climate change, we mean current rapid climate change caused by CO2 emissions from industrialization.
Well, and there we say the evidence is not clear. Here's the thing. First off, you say rapid. It's no more rapid than it was at the end of the last ice age when, in fact, less rapid when over the course of about 50 years, temperature rose 9 degrees mm-hmm. on average globally. Mm-hmm. That's much more fast. It's mm-hmm. much faster than we're experiencing now. So, and we've had periods just in the last 4,000 years mm-hmm. when it has been as warm or warmer than it is now. And, of course, periods, little ice ages, maunder minimums, when it's been much cooler. We don't believe the evidence is in that the current warming, and we have experienced a warming of about a degree, 1.2 degrees over the past 150 years, is that unusual and driven primarily by human greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay, why?
Well, because it's not unusual. It's happened before without human greenhouse gas emissions, and the idea that you can tie this modest warming primarily to human greenhouse gas emissions, we just don't think the evidence is there, especially when you realize that most of these projections are based on climate models, mm-hmm. which overstate the amount of warming, consistently overstate the amount of warming that we have in fact experienced, that those pushing the idea that humans are causing climate change constantly fiddle with raw data, the actual recorded data, to try and make it fit models.
Okay, pause for that, because I'm looking, okay. And it took a little bit of digging, but I'm looking at a press release from yourself from 2009, and what you wrote then was, contrary to what all the climate models have predicted, over the past decade, the global average temperature has fallen to its lowest level in 30 years. Now, I'm looking at the list.
Now, I actually said that, or the Heartland Institute released a press release that said that. That's a quote from me?
It's attributed to you, and it's in quotations, and I got it from the Wayback Machine, that's to say the Internet Archive, from the NCPA, and it's put in their press release quoting you as a senior fellow of the NCPA.
Okay.
The reason...
I'm not saying I didn't say it. I don't know.
Okay. It does appear from that quote, and I'm sure, you know, you write a lot of things, and I'm not expecting you to remember every single thing that you write. But it does appear from that quote that that the meaning of that is that you don't believe that the climate is getting warmer. And I was just going to, and that was written in 2009, so that's nearly a decade ago. But my point is that the 10 hottest years on record, we have records going back to 1880, and the 10 hottest years in that nearly 140 years, of the 10 hottest, 9 have occurred since you wrote that.
Well, let's look at that. Let's parse that for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Your claim is of the 10 hottest years. I've seen that claim. Unfortunately, that claim was made after scientists went back and fiddled with data from the 1930s. We had three of the hottest years of the last 150 years recorded in the 1930s. And NOAA used to have this on their website, and NOAA went back, pulled that data, downgraded that data, said, oh, we need to adjust the recordings because we've decided there was a bias back then.
Mm-hmm.
So they've made that data smaller, the temperature recordings then, the adjusted data smaller, and so the current data looks higher. But in fact, if you look at their, people have archived, archived their screenshots mm-hmm. of when they had their initial data up there, and it shows that at least 3 years in the 30s were as hot as it has been in the last decade. So,
okay, hold on for a second. You said there that they have adjusted the records. Now, in the past, In the past 30 or 40 years, we've had very sophisticated measurements of the temperature. Clearly, going back to 1880, there wasn't as sophisticated a recording, and the measurement systems were not so sophisticated. And it is, of course, scientifically legitimate to look at those records and correlate them with current ones. Are you suggesting that somebody has done more than that and faked the information?
What I'm suggesting is it's awful convenient that consistently, not just in the U.S., but in countries around the world, since they've been worried about humans causing climate change, even in locations that are not degraded due to the urban heat island effect, that aren't, you know, locations where they're not affected by local human causes of heat,
mm-hmm.
they adjust the data there, and all the data in the past is adjusted so it's lower than was actually recorded.
I want to clarify, Sterling, what you're saying. You said it's awful convenient. Are you accusing them of dishonesty?
I don't know whether they're being dishonest. What I'm saying is it's not random. What I'm saying, sir, let mm-hmm. me finish. It's not random. It's unusual that all the data in the past is consistently changed from what is actually recorded to a lower temperature, and all the present data is adjusted, and it's always warmer. It's consistent in that pattern, and that is odd. That's not a random correction. Why? There's no reason to believe that the temperature recordings in locations that are isolated from human civilizations that they've been recording over the past 100 years. Suddenly we decide, well, we can't trust their past. We can't trust the past. And when we change it, we adjust it downward, and we can't trust the present. And so when we change it, it's adjusted upward.
Hold on for a second. The NOAA that you referred to, I should explain for listeners, is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. This is U.S. government agency that are tasked with a wide range of functions, but one of them is literally just measuring the climate, having thousands of temperature stations and so forth. The figures that they publish show that since you wrote that press release in 2009, 9 of the 10 hottest years on record since 1880 have happened. That's what they're saying. And by the way, the 10th was 1998, which was also a very hot year. But are you suggesting that they're lying?
I'm not going to go on record and saying as they're lying. I'm saying it's an odd thing that when they adjust past temperatures, they're always adjusted cooler, and when they adjust present temperatures, they're always adjusted warmer. I can't explain
if you don't want to go on record.
Let's look at NOAA for a second.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me we're spending an inordinate amount of time on a degree of temperature as opposed to the moral things that I want to talk about.
I do want to move on to that, but I want to get your position clear, because NOAA are obviously a U.S. government agency.
I don't trust their data. My position is clear. I don't trust their data based on the manipulations of data they have made.
Do you have better data?
Well, for the past 40 years, we have satellite data.
Mm-hmm.
And I trust the satellite data. And the satellite data shows much less warming than has been recorded by NOAA, and even less warming than has been projected by climate models that were supposed to scare us about climate change. The satellite data is clear that we had a hiatus in warming for over 18 years until the last couple of years. 18 years when CO2 emissions were rising, supposedly causing warming, and no warming was occurring.
Okay, you're right. I want to move on to a different topic on this, but just to go with the facts as published by NOAA, the number one hottest year on record in the past 140 years was 2016. The number two was 2015. The number three was 2017. And all the way down to the number eight, the top eight hottest years all happened since 2005. That seems to be an incredible statistic that nine of the top 10 in the last 140 years have happened in the last 12 years. If you don't accept that, that's fair enough.
NOAA,
I'm not a scientist.
Say again? Okay, but NOAA, when they first came out with that particular data,
mm-hmm.
What did they do differently starting in 2015 that they hadn't done before? I can tell you. Most of the Earth is covered in water,
mm-hmm.
the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And we have buoys mm-hmm. in the oceans mm-hmm. that are not affected by any kind of, other than the metal just around the buoy. Are not affected by what we call on land the urban heat island effect, basically human interferences.
That's disputed,
and
but go ahead.
They're better sources of data than the urban heat island effect, than temperature locations set next to air conditioners surrounded by asphalt. I don't know anyone who disputes that.
Uh-huh.
And so in 2015, what did NOAA suddenly start doing? They said, well, we want more readings. And so we're going to take temperature readings from ocean-going vessels from their cooling intake valves next to their engines.
But slow down, Sterling, I understand that you dispute that, but you've said that you don't want to go on record saying that they're lying, and that's a reasonable position to take. But do you think that they are just wildly mistaken, or do you think that they are intentionally given incorrect figures?
I think the stuff with the ocean water, I think, was a political manipulation.
Oh, okay. That's your position.
In the run-up to the Paris Climate Agreement, because you don't – if I want to give someone clean water, I don't take bottled water, mix it with dirty water from a river, and say, here's clean water.
Okay.
You don't take bad data, mix it with good data, and suddenly produce better data, which is what NOAA did in 2015.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I would have to say that the great bulk of people who study this accept the measurements of temperature which give that ranking. And I accept that you don't accept it. And that's fair enough. But you are a specialist and I think you have a PhD in environmental ethics. And that's where I'm really interested here.
That's a
philosophical degree. It's not a scientific degree, I understand. Is that correct?
It's not. Part of the applied aspect it was taking was doing statistics, biology, geographical information systems. I didn't have to take a language requirement. I used science to fill that.
Okay. And then I suppose my question is, where there is risk, and if me doing something puts you at risk, where does the line get drawn that the action that I'm taking puts you, when I put you at risk, where does the line get drawn about when my behavior should be stopped by government action?
That's a good and tough question. Every time I go out on the road, I'm putting somebody at risk. Every time someone else goes out on the road, they're putting me at risk. Government doesn't ban us from going out on the roads. The risk, I would say, has to be not just we don't lock you up or stop you from exercising your freedom in the normal course of events, unless the risk not just that there's a risk, but there's a high likelihood based on past evidence that I'm going to do you harm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the picture of climate change, and also you've got to remember, it's also a balancing act because the risk is never just one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
When you impose a restriction on somebody, you're limiting their freedom, you're also imposing costs and harms and risk.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if it's one-sided. If you impose a policy, the policy is going to help some and harm others.
Mm-hmm.
And so in looking at climate change from my perspective, I say, okay, what are the risks that we are concerned about, and what are the risks we face today, and what risks are likely to be enhanced if we take certain actions?
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about, you know, there's a range of actions that people have proposed to prevent further warming. But most of them involve restricting the use of fossil fuels or sharply curtailing it.
Yep.
I think you'd agree with that.
Yes, absolutely.
So my question is, when I'm looking at climate actions, actions to fight so-called anthropogenic global warming, okay, we know what they say the risk might be of further warming,
mm-hmm.
and we know what people face today. So, for instance, decarbonization. Carbon is the lifeblood right now of the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting off the use of oil, natural gas, coal will harm us. There's just no question about that. It's more than 80% of our energy. So let's be clear. Now, we're relatively wealthy. Look, I'm not a rich man, but compared to people in many parts of Africa or Latin America.
Pause on that for a second, Sterling,
because
you're right. Okay. You're actually, okay. You know, it's unquestionably correct that there will be, at the very least, economic difficulties posed by decarbonization, by moving away from fossil fuels. But there will also be harms by not doing it. And even if you discount climate change, which is a pretty big discount to make, we see, for example, with diesel fuel and the scandal with Volkswagen, that there are tens and in some cases hundreds of thousands of people a year dying from emissions from fossil-fueled vehicles. That's something that needs to be balanced as well, isn't it?
Well, now, I guess this is one of those things that we would also argue about, is how many people are actually dying from fossil fuels, from emissions of automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
There are studies on both sides of that. If you look at studies on ozone or particulate matter, mm-hmm. there's plenty of evidence that PM2.5 is not causing tens of thousands of deaths. But you know what does, which no one disputes that I know of, is hundreds of thousands of people die every year in third world countries burning dung and wood mm-hmm. inside their homes for heating
yep.
and cooking from respiratory illnesses that in the U.S., we largely wiped out.
Yes, this is worth noting.
Our lifespan has grown.
Living in a town where people are burning wood is probably as bad as smoking for your health. And that is notable. But that's not the situation in the West. And those problems absolutely exist, and lots of problems exist, but the existence of one problem...
They could take us back to that, though.
Sure. Hold on for a second. The existence of one problem isn't a good reason to not solve another problem. Simply being able to point to a problem that isn't being solved isn't a good reason not to solve any problem.
Hold on for a second.
Sorry. You said that you can't run cities and hospitals on wind and solar. Why not?
Well, wind and solar are variable. They can't be counted upon. A hospital, let's compare a modern hospital to having a child in a third world country. Okay, in a modern hospital, my wife, she gets pregnant, she goes in for sonograms.
Okay, no, hold on a second. I don't want to go into great detail of that. There is electronic equipment that is needed. There are countries that are running a very high proportion.
Refrigeration that's needed.
Sure. And hold on for a second. When John F. Kennedy, in, I believe, 1961, said that we're going to put a man on the moon and bring him safely home, the technology to do that simply didn't exist. Within 9 years, they had created it. The point being that technology isn't something that just randomly falls out of the sky. Humans develop technology that they need. And if we invest in the technology that we need to produce energy in a stable, reliable way without using carbon, then there's no reason why we can't do that, is there?
Well, you say that. Maybe there's not. Maybe there is. We don't know in advance whether he set a goal. And it was a very specific and relatively small goal. Solving the world's energy needs is not specific and small. it's a very different kind of goal. And we've been trying to solve cancer,
in large parts, it has been solved.
The price of wind energy is falling
sharply. The price of solar energy is...
1.2 billion people in the world, 1.2 billion people today, don't have access to regular electricity. They can't go to the hospital in the middle of the night and have a child because there are no lights on. They don't have refrigeration for the medicine, and they can't run their their incubators if they're born early.
Let me ask you a question, Sterling. There's a reason why people in developing countries have such
poor lifespans. Sterling,
let me ask you then a question. You say 1.2. I think you're correct in that figure. 1.2 billion people, that's about 20% of the population, have no regular access to electricity, which makes their life very, very much less comfortable than what we in the West would expect. Do you think
Impoverished.
Do you think that bringing them energy, bringing them electricity, is more likely to happen via wind and solar, or via massively increasing the amount of oil and coal being produced?
Well, I think fossil fuels are necessary. It may not be oil for electricity. We hardly burn oil for electricity, though they do in some developing countries. It would be natural gas and coal. Electrification happened
Hold on, Sterling. Even if you don't accept anything about what NOAA or the United Nations says about climate change, the increase in the demand for carbon energy to bring electricity to those people at the level that it's used in the West would simply be undoable.
I've never seen any statistics that say it would be undoable, and even the UN says that carbon sources of electricity will still make up in 2050 80% of the supply. That's from the UN Energy Agency. So I'm not spinning out fantasy here. I'm saying, what's more likely to electrify 200,000 homes? A 200 megawatt or 1,000 megawatt coal-fired power plant in one location, or 200,000 or 100,000 wind turbines spread across a landscape and huge battery farms to back that up, or solar panels and battery farms to back that up. That seems to me to be much less likely to electrify those homes and villages than a coal-fired power plant or a natural gas-fired power plant.
And more importantly,
do it on a short time scale compared to the technology. You say it's comparable. We can do it today. No, it's not comparable and do it today. No one. We do not in the West back up solar and wind with battery farms. We backed them up with natural gas plants. And when I say backed them up, what I mean is they're actually running at less efficient levels all the time.
Because just to explain that for the listeners, Sterling, the wind farms do not produce the same amount of energy all the time, but over a wider range they do, because the level of wind here is quite likely to be always different to the amount of wind in some place that's 100 or 200 miles away.
So we cover the countryside with turbines, and we cover the countryside with wires, and we destroy birds, and we destroy wildlife habitat, and we do all sorts of other things, and we hope that we don't have completely calm days, or we don't have big storms that hit that have winds too fast that we have to shutter those wind turbines so they don't get ripped down over a wide swath.
But there are days in winter when, for example, Germany, which has invested hugely in wind energy, there are days in winter when Germany shuts down all other sources of electricity and runs the entire country on wind turbines.
They do. And what is Germany's electric prices compared to the U.S.? 3 times the price, because they're not cheaper. They're not comparable.
But that means it's possible.
And what is their backup? Coal. Because they're shutting down their nuclear plants.
That's
so
true. Yes.
Let's be clear. They're not battery farms. Their wind is not backed up by battery farms. It's backed up by coal.
Sure. Yes, that's it's true that
there are days when there are not battery farms. Yeah, and there are days when their wind is not blowing so much and they're burning more coal, which is why Germany's emissions over the past 2 years have grown.
Let me put one other thing to you in that case, Sterling. Al Gore, in his film The Inconvenient Truth, made a point that it's very difficult to convince somebody of something when their paycheck depends on them not believing it. Your employer, the Heartland Institute, is largely funded by fossil fuel industries. Isn't it the case?
That's false. No, that's false.
Where do you get your funding?
I can't stand. We've got 5,000 donors. Fossil fuel industry makes up less than 5% of our donor base,
what percentage of the
oil.
Cash value of the dollar?
None of
value?
It's from oil. In fact, I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm not a fundraiser.
Okay,
that's not my my job at the institute. So I don't know. What I know is we get no money from the American Petroleum Institute or Exxon or any oil company.
Do you get money from the Koch brothers?
We got one grant in 2009 of $25,000 from the Koch brothers.
And do you get other money from companies or institutes associated with the Koch brothers?
Not to my knowledge, but once again, as I said, I'm not a fundraiser, so I can't.
Okay. Well, let me make the point in any case. Do you not think, maybe, Sterling, it's notable that the entire scientific community is on a different side to the Heartland Institute, which is funded at least in part by people who have a very strong financial interest in not believing in climate change?
I guess what I would think is notable is two things. First off, not the entire scientific community, since I can bring you the names of 300 noted scientists who write peer-reviewed papers saying humans aren't causing a climate catastrophe. Are they contributing to climate change? Most of them would say yes. Is it the dominant source? That is open to dispute. Is it catastrophe? I think they would say, many of them have written, it's less likely to be catastrophe than limiting fossil fuel use. Now, so I'm not going to agree that the entire scientific community disagrees with our position. Secondly, I would say it's
funny.
Would
you agree the great bulk of it does?
I would say the great bulk of it, yeah. But you know what? The great bulk of it is not climate scientists. And when we're talking climate change,
okay,
I care about climate
experts.
Would
you say the great bulk of climate scientists disagree with you?
I would say some do and some don't.
Where does the majority fall, in your opinion?
Well, a majority may fall on the other side.
Okay. That's fair enough. And you've been honest on that, sir. But I want to
democracy.
move to one other thing.
But wait, no, you also said something about funding. I want to talk about funding.
Mm-hmm.
All the climate realists or climate skeptics in the world receive a paltry maybe millions of dollars in funding. I'm not just talking about Heartland. I'm talking about all the groups that we work with and all the scientists that we work with, millions of dollars in funding. Billions of dollars in funding go to people who are wedded to the view of human-caused climate change, and that funding dries up if the disaster disappears. If their theory is questioned, if the modeling goes away,
what's your
billions
evidence for that?
Of dollars in funding. You tell me. I'm sorry?
What's your evidence for that? You said that
more money,
funding
more
would
money
go
is,
away
more
if,
money
they,
is
if, they,
into climate
if they
research.
If they did not
because more money has poured into climate research in the last decade and a half, two decades, than was in the entirety of it throughout its history. Before that, because
sure,
it only
sure,
became
of course. Yeah, people,
largely
people are
funded
researching.
By governments when it became a crisis.
Yeah,
if it's
yeah
no
absolutely.
Crisis,
hold on, for, no, Sterling, hold on for a second. It's absolutely normal, Sterling. It's absolutely normal that when there is a threat or a perceived threat, that governments will pay money to research to find out more about it. That's only rational, isn't it?
No, it's not to find out more about it. If
oh, hold on, there's the Zika virus. The Zika virus appeared.
Sterling,
the Zika virus appeared in the Caribbean and some parts of South America a couple of years ago, and a huge amount of funding was put into finding out about it, finding out how to cure it, finding out perhaps how to get a vaccine from it. That doesn't demonstrate that the Zika virus doesn't exist, does it?
The Zika virus still exists, and how much funding is going to it? It's killing people today.
But the fact that a lot of money, Sterling, the fact that a lot of money was spent on researching it doesn't undermine the validity of the science.
No, but I'm not. The money is not all going into researching it, and more importantly, ask yourself this. And be honest, ask yourself this. If tomorrow the consensus changed, I mean, I can't imagine it, and I'm not talking about because of physical science. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine it because I can't imagine what these guys, it would do to these guys' reputations.
Well, hold on for a second. Let me pause you on that. You're saying, no, hold on for a second, Sterling. You're saying a specific thing here that I want to, Sterling, I want to ask you on this specifically.
Okay.
Sterling, you say that people are motivated not to change the consensus. That's not how science works. The way that people get Nobel Prizes is not by agreeing with the consensus. The way that people get Nobel Prizes is by proving something that was not previously believed to be true.
It's beautiful that you said that. I appreciate that you said that.
So if somebody could come up with the evidence that climate change does not exist, they should be booking their flights to Oslo.
I want to follow up on that.
Okay.
So consensus is not science. And that's part of the point is Galileo was right, and he wasn't in the consensus. Just 150 years ago, they were talking about humors in the blood and balancing humors in the blood and science.
Sterling, do you think that the average scientist out there is motivated to be like Galileo?
I think the average scientist out there right now, since the 50s, when big government got into funding science, which is something Eisenhower warned about in the same speech, he warned about the military-industrial complex, he warned about the science and government complex. I think big science has captured scientists. They go where funding goes, and funding goes where disaster goes. And when disasters go away, when the Zika virus is no longer in the news, funding for it drops. Doesn't mean people aren't still dying from it, but it's not sexy. It's not where the money is.
Okay, made that point, Sterling. You've made that point, and I don't want to labor that point anymore. I want to go to just to one last point. In 2012, the Heartland Institute erected billboards in Chicago with a picture of Ted Kaczynski. He was the Unabomber, a guy who lived in the woods and posted bombs and murdered three people. And the slogan, the dominant text on that poster said, "I still believe in global warming. Do you?" And you've got a PhD in the philosophy area.
Yeah.
That's an ad hominem fallacy, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. And I wasn't with Heartland at the time.
And quite a lot of people left the Heartland Institute over that, didn't they?
I can't speak to that. I wasn't at Heartland at the time.
That was reported, though, that people left.
That was years before I joined Heartland.
It does indicate that the Heartland Institute is more interested in essentially slandering people than they are in real science, doesn't it?
No, I don't think it indicates that. Slander, I'm called a denier, linking me to Holocaust deniers all the time. That's ad hominem. And I don't see
the mainstream press saying,
you've not seen New York Times articles and Washington Post articles and numerous publications calling people science deniers? You've never seen that term? I find that hard to believe. I truly find that hard to believe.
And I don't think that ad hominems are a good idea. I don't think that ad hominems are a good idea from anyone. But you did earlier in this call dispute the validity, and it wasn't clear whether you were saying whether they were being dishonest or whether they were being mistaken or for some other reason you disputed the validity of the statistics, the temperature statistics.
I'm not a mind reader. I can't get into people's motives. I think that the data is not. A lot of the recent data, for the reasons I have or would have explained, have been doctored to some degree. Once again, I look at the satellite data, and it doesn't show the same warming that the land-based data showed, especially after they went and shifted how we record ocean data.
Sterling Burnett, Senior Fellow in Energy and the Environment at the Heartland Institute, also the Managing Editor of their Environment and Climate News. You've been a very good sport, and it's a spirited conversation. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me on. Take care.
If you like the Challenging Opinions podcast, please rate and review the show on iTunes and other podcast providers. Share it on Facebook and Twitter. Tell your friends, but most important, make your view heard. Email podcast@challengingopinions.com.
That's all for the Challenging Opinions podcast, published on February 26th, 2018. You can find links and references for the things that I cited in the podcast in the show notes on the website. Do you know someone who I should interview? Do you know another topic I should be covering? I'd be really interested to hear your feedback and your suggestions, so get in touch. And if you like the podcast, please do go on iTunes, give the podcast a rating, and write a short review. That's very helpful to let other people find the podcast, and there's a link directly on the website to the iTunes page. Also, please like the show on Facebook. On Twitter, you can follow the show @ChallengingO. And most important, subscribe to the show for free. You can use Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast app or software. There's links and an RSS feed for all of that on the website. And if you don't use a podcast app or software, you can subscribe by email. Just enter your email address on the Challenging Opinions website. Each time a new show goes online, you get a simple email with no spam, just a link to listen on the website. You can find all of that or get in touch with me at www.challengingopinions.com. Coming up next Monday, that's March 5th, I'll be talking to Heather Jones again. You might remember that last September I talked to her when she was the editor of the alt-right website Black Pigeon Speaks. She's left that website now and she's changed a lot of her views, and I'll be talking to her about what she thinks the alt-right get wrong. The Challenging Opinions podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.